Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live for an hour each weekday afternoon. And we're taking your calls each day as you have questions about the Bible that come to your mind and you want to call somebody and talk about them. You can call me. We can talk about them. And if you have listened to this program before or you listen to it today and you hear this host say anything that you think is not correct and you'd like to balance comment or correction, bring correction, feel free. You're welcome to do that here. This is really an open forum, and there's only one thing we're interested in here in doing, and that's establishing what the Bible actually does teach about things, our beliefs, our behaviors, our choices that we make, our commitments, our obligations, and so forth. So if you're interested in participating, I just want to say we have all of our lines open right now, and if you call right now, you will get through. The number to call is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Now, any of you who might be planning to be in Southern California this weekend, Saturday in particular, I'm speaking on a topic called Strategies for Unity. On Saturday night, I do this. I do a monthly talk in Temecula, where I live in Southern California. It's in Riverside County, and between San Diego and Riverside, if you know the area. If you're going to be down here in Southern California and you're going to want to do something on Saturday night that's edifying, I think you might enjoy coming on out and seeing us. We'd love to meet our listeners there. And you can find information about the time and the location at our website. That website is thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. And if you click the tab that says announcements, that's where you'll see my upcoming speaking engagements, and love to, as I say, meet any of our listeners who may be in the area. Let's talk first of all to Mark calling from Beaverton, Oregon. Mark, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Yesterday, someone called in about Pontius Pilate's wife having dreams about Jesus. And I think they were wondering if those dreams were from God. But I was thinking, the point of Jesus coming here, one of the main points was for him to die. So I don't think God would give someone a dream to try and prevent a crucifixion of Jesus from happening, because isn't that what God wanted to have happen in the end anyway?
Well, that's a good thought, a good point. I think that even though God wanted Jesus to die, that didn't prevent God from still convicting people about their role in it. For example, Pilate definitely felt conviction that he had done a wrong thing when he condemned Jesus. That's why he wanted to wash his hands. He felt guilty. It may be that God was still saying, don't go, don't go, don't do this, even though God knew they were going to. But you're right. I mean, it could be the devil's desire to prevent the crucifixion, and therefore we can't be sure that this woman had a dream from God. Actually, the question the person asked, I think, was whether we knew if Pontius Pilate's wife was a Christian or a believer or not, and we don't know that. We don't know that, but you raise another interesting question, is whether the dream she had was even from God or not.
Okay, sorry, I misunderstood what was being said yesterday, but yeah, that just came to my mind. It figures that if it wasn't for the death of Christ, none of us would be saved. So,
yeah, you know, you make a good point.
Okay, have a good day.
Thanks for sharing that with us. God bless you.
You too.
Bye now. Okay, our next caller is Sue calling from Everett, Washington. We do still have a line open for you at 1-800-438-5090 if you'd like to join us. It's 1-800-438-5090. Sue, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. My question is, do you still have questions that you haven't answered, and where do you go to answer your questions?
Well, I do still have some questions unanswered, but where I've always gone to answer my questions is, first of all, to the Bible. I try to see if the Bible has an answer to a question that I have. And then if it doesn't seem obvious, that the Bible does have an answer, then I will often look to see if other Christians have seen something there that I have not seen. That would normally mean looking at Christian books on the subject, written by Christian authors, or maybe commentaries on certain verses that are hard. I consult all the same kinds of resources that any Christian can. I don't have any special resources available to me, but my first, usually when I have a question about something, going to the Bible itself is the best option. And in frankly, I think scores of cases, if not hundreds of cases over the years, the Bible itself has answered my questions when I've gone to it. But there are things that the Bible doesn't answer or does not answer explicitly, in which case, you know, getting insights from people who've studied it and who might have seen something that I haven't seen is always a good option. But even after doing that, sometimes I conclude that all the authors I've read don't appear to know the answer either. Sometimes they say so, and sometimes they act like they know the answer, but the answer they give is very unconvincing. So, so there are many things that, you know, I just don't know what the answer is. And I have to assume that if the answer is not immediately forthcoming, or if even study does not yield the answer, it must not be one of the highest priorities in God's mind for me to know the answer to that question.
Okay. And when you're studying the Bible, for those of us who aren't well-versed in the languages or the customs, or because every time I hear it, it's context, but, you know, I don't necessarily understand the context because I don't have such a good understanding of the language or whatever. What are good resources, you know, just like a beginner's resource for that?
Well, you know, there's not just one book or two or three that I could recommend. I've got a whole library sitting right next to me, which contains hundreds of volumes that I would consider to be each useful in its own way. When I started teaching, in fact, the first time I taught through the Bible, I didn't have very many resources available to me. And I didn't know much. I was only, 16, 17 years old or something like that. But what I had was a Haley's Bible Handbook. And Haley's Bible Handbook has some views in it that I don't agree with today, but it was a very helpful little thing. It's a small book, but it goes through every book of the Bible and gives background information. It goes through every chapter of each book and gives kind of a summary of what's in there. And if there's some maybe historical background that's helpful to know, or if there's some other background that's important, sometimes, usually, it'll say something about that. It's not at all a comprehensive book. It's not like having a commentary. I could recommend commentaries. They are helpful, too, in measure. Or, frankly, study Bibles. Lots of people ask me which study Bible I recommend, and I don't really recommend that anyone use a study Bible as their main Bible for biblical study. I think it's better to have a Bible that doesn't have those notes in it for your own studies. But a study Bible has commentary at the bottom of the page. And so if you can't afford a set of commentaries, a good study Bible will have some of the information that might be helpful at the bottom of the page. I say some of, because there's no telling how much information might be helpful. Sometimes just some basic historical information is absolutely necessary to understand a passage in Jeremiah or something. But a lot more information could be even more helpful. And, you know, there's it's hard to place a limit on how much information you might desire to acquire, which could still be useful to you. So I'm always trying to learn more. I mean, I know enough about the background of all the books of the Bible and all the chapters of the Bible that I could say something, informed about them. But there's so much that yet to learn. And I'm right now at this stage in my studies, and I've been, you know, a teacher for 45 years now, but I'm really becoming fascinated with reading the Church Fathers. The Church Fathers, the guys who wrote, the Christian leaders who wrote in the 2nd century and the 3rd century. And I'm reading them not so much because I want them to tell me what to think, because I don't actually agree with some of the things they say, just like I don't agree with some of the commentators today. But it's very interesting from my point of view, to see the history of Christian thought, especially the earliest Christian thought on certain things. So there's always more to learn. I've always been fascinated with Christian history, and that's almost like a bottomless pit of information to dive into. You can never know it all. So it's, you know, anyone who thinks they've done their learning, you know, they became a Christian and they maybe went through the Bible in the first couple of years of their Christian life, and they figure, okay, I'm in there. I know what's going on, and they don't study anymore. I think, what in the world are they thinking? You know,
right.
there's so much more to learn. I've read through the Bible more than 30 times, and I still have right. so many things I want to understand better.
And where, I mean, a new, like a baby Christian, what would you, where would you point them to start their study?
Well, I think probably the New Testament is more valuable to a brand new Christian than the Old Testament is, though I think a person ought to read both, maybe not simultaneously, or maybe even, you know, if somebody started reading through Genesis, and let's say in the mornings they read a portion, maybe a chapter of Genesis, and in the evenings a chapter from the New Testament, start going through, you know, Matthew and going through, that might be a good way to do it. I can't really say, because I can't remember being a baby Christian. I was raised in the faith, and I had some Bible knowledge kind of factory installed just in my upbringing. So I can't remember a time when it was like a clean slate completely and just had to start learning the Bible from scratch. I knew the Bible somewhat before I was in my teens, of course. So, you know, I've read through the Bible sometimes. Well, some books of the Bible I've read through, I'm sure, 50 times easily. Maybe more. Other books of the Bible I've read through only, you know, somewhat fewer times than that. But I've read through the whole Bible multiple times. But I don't know that I always start in the same place. You know, I think that to gain a thorough knowledge of the Bible, it's very valuable to read right through from beginning to end repeatedly. And, you know, if you do read through the Old Testament from beginning to end, what you're going to do is you're going to read through the historical books before you read any of the poetical or prophetic books. And that's helpful, because when you read Isaiah or Jeremiah or Ezekiel, they always reference, you know, who is the king in Israel, or who is the king in Judah at that time, you know. And if you've already read the books of Kings and Chronicles, then you have some background information about what was going on, who that king was, whether he was a good king or a bad king. Some of the things going on around him, some of the whether he was threatened by the Assyrians or by the Syrians or by the Babylonians. I mean, if you read the historical books of the Old Testament first, then when you read the prophets, they reference them. They reference, you know, I mean, the prophets lived during the same period of time that the books of Kings are talking about. So I think reading through from beginning to end is not a bad idea. For some people, there may be a better way to do it. I'm not saying it's always going to be, you know, the same thing for everyone, but I would think that no one would hurt themselves any by reading from Genesis through Revelation, or reading Old and New Testament simultaneously. That couldn't hurt either, I don't think.
Because I have a friend who's a baby Christian, but I don't quite know where to send her to, you know, really get more... I mean, I try to answer her questions, but I don't want her to constantly come to me. I want her to learn for herself. And so I suggested to start with the Book of John, and that's kind of where I remember starting. And I learned about, you know, reading the letters as if I were reading a letter to me. And understanding it that way, because mm-hmm. the different books of the Bible are different types of literature.
That's right.
And so you would read that literature, you'd read a letter different than you would read a poem, or than you would read a history. And so I tried to explain to her about the letter aspect of John, and that she should try to read it as if he were writing her a letter, you know, if she were a person back in the church in that day. That's kind of where he was focusing on.
The most important thing you could advise her, I think, is that you should tell her to pray that the Holy Spirit will speak to her through the scriptures and will open her eyes to understand the scriptures before she reads. And I think that that's going to be the most important thing. Now, she should also not have such high expectations as to think that once she reads through the Bible, she's going to know it all. There's too much in there. She's going to have to read it again and again and again and again. And some people might say, well, that sounds like a long project. Exactly. It's a lifelong project. And what better thing do you have to do with the rest of your life? I can't imagine anything better than that to do with the rest of your life.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, I always do, and thank you for reminding me, because I did neglect to say that to her, that that's the most important place to start is with prayer, and then to dive in.
Yeah.
So I'll be reminded to tell her that.
Okay, Sue. Thanks for your call.
Bye.
Okay, bye now. All right, and we have a line open for you. You're listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and if you'd like to be on the program, the number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Our next caller in line is Michael from Live Oak, California. Hi, Michael. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. Good to hear you today. I have two very quick questions.
Okay.
Number one, so how would the Protestant world, yourself included, regard the miracles, the very famous miracles that have occurred within the Catholic tradition, such as Fatima,
right,
and so on? That's the first question.
Okay. Well, uncharitable as it might sound, I think most Protestants would think that those miracles, so-called, either are not genuine miracles, or else that they are genuinely supernatural, but not from God. You see, the Christian faith, and I believe even the Catholic Church would agree with this, believes that there's more than one supernatural power that can speak to people. The devil can, and God can. Now, a person who has never heard or seen anything supernatural with their eyes or their ears or their mind, of course, is totally unequipped to recognize the difference between a supernatural thing that comes from God or a supernatural thing that comes from Satan, unless they determine it by its content. In other words, you know, if I have a vision, well, how do I know if that's from God or from the devil or from the pepperoni pizza I ate last night? Mm-hmm. How do I know? Well, certainly one of the factors that's a dead giveaway is its content. Now, Moses told the children of Israel in Deuteronomy chapter 13 that they should beware, because there will be prophets who will come, and he says they will give a sign or a wonder, a supernatural sign or wonder, which actually comes to pass. So what Moses is picturing here is somebody comes along and they say, I can prove that I'm a prophet because this such and such thing is going to happen, and then lo and behold, it does. So, okay, suddenly you've encountered what appears to be the supernatural. The question is this person a real prophet or a false prophet? Is this supernatural thing from God or not? Well, it says further, as you go further into the chapter, it says, if this person says, let's depart from Yahweh and serve other gods, then you will not listen. Do not pay heed to that prophet or that dreamer of dreams, because that, he says, the Lord your God is testing you to see if you love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul. What this suggests is that even a person who claims to be a godly person, a prophet of God, coming to Israel in that particular instance, could possibly do supernatural things, and they turn out to not be really from God at all because they're leading people astray. So, in other words, the content of the supernatural revelation would be the one thing that it's a dead giveaway, that it's not from God. In the New Testament, similarly, we are given similar things to test supernatural phenomena by. In 1 John 4:1, it says, Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits whether they are of God. And then he goes on to tell to test them by, frankly, their theological content. And Paul, that's John talking, but Paul says a similar thing in 1 Corinthians 12. He says, no one speaking by the Spirit of God could say Jesus is accursed. Now, what he's suggesting, of course, is once again, someone who claims to be speaking by the Spirit of God, you listen to what it is they're saying. What is the information they're giving? If it's bad information, then it's not to be trusted. So both the Old Testament prophet Moses and the New Testament apostles, Paul and John, both said that false prophets will be recognized by what they say. Now, in this case, maybe Fatima isn't technically a prophet speaking, mm-hmm. but let's allow that it really is a supernatural occurrence.
Right.
Let's allow that there really are visions that people have seen that are supernatural, or supernatural things that have happened, mm-hmm. Healings mm-hmm. at Lourdes, or let's say the stigmata appearing,
right.
These things, if they are true, if they really happen, then they appear to be supernatural. But that doesn't mean they're from God. Even the fact that they happen within a religious community doesn't mean they're from God, because all the cases that I just gave you that Moses talked about and that the apostle talked about were things that happened in the religious community, among the Jews in Deuteronomy 13, or in the church in 1 Corinthians or 1 John. So we can see that you can't know if something is really from God or if it's from the devil simply by the fact that it appears to be supernatural and it occurs in a religious community. There's many very gullible Protestants in this respect, too. There are some things that are reported as supernatural taking place in some Pentecostal circles, which by their very nature, I think, distract from Jesus and therefore become somewhat suspicious as whether they're from God or not. I have my doubts about many of them. I'd have my doubts about these apparitions of Mary and so forth, which seem to confirm Catholic mistaken notions about her.
Does the stigmata occur in Protestant circles, like along with speaking in tongues, or is that strictly?
I've never heard of it. I mean, it may have happened, but I've never heard of any Protestants receiving the stigmata.
Does speaking in tongues happen within Catholicism that you know of?
In charismatic Catholic circles. I mean, there are charismatic Catholics as well as charismatic Protestants, and they have been known to speak in tongues, yes.
All right. Anyway, Steve, my second question very quickly. Yesterday you mentioned that Martin Luther was an Augustinian.
Yes.
And that so he believed in predestination. Mm-hmm. So the official doctrine of the Catholic Church from St. Augustine was predestination pretty much along the same lines as Calvinism, obviously?
No, I don't believe so. I don't believe so. The Catholic Church was very much influenced by Augustine, but did not hold to all of his views. The Reformation was also very much influenced by Augustine, but didn't necessarily hold to all of his views. For example, Augustine believed that the Church of Rome should be the primary church over all the churches, and this gives rise to the idea of the Pope, the Roman bishop being over all the bishops of the world. Augustine believed that, and the Roman Catholics believe that, but the Protestants don't. But Augustine also taught this, what we'd call Calvinism, the doctrine of the Reformation, and the Roman Catholics don't accept that, but Protestants, some Protestants do, the Reformed people do. So Augustine wrote a tremendous body of work. He wrote lots and lots of pages. Several volumes on my bookshelf are written by Augustine. And in them, he purported lots of different theological ideas. Some of them I don't think any Christians alive today would agree with, but some of them influenced Roman Catholicism, and some other ones influenced, the Protestant Reformation. I don't think either the Catholics or the Protestants would admit that they hold to what they do because of Augustine. I think the Roman Catholics would acknowledge that some of the things they believe were taught by Augustine.
And
Protestants would agree that some of the things they teach were taught by Augustine, but I think they would all say, well, this really goes back before Augustine.
So Luther himself was not hard and fast saying that predestination is the way that it is.
Yes, Luther actually did. Luther believed in predestination along lines somewhat similar, I think, to Calvinism, but I'm not sure in what ways they differed. Luther's doctrine is distinguished from Calvin's in some small ways, but they were both, reformers, and they both held very similar Augustinian ideas. So
this is totally new to me, because I thought that what Martin Luther was protesting was the authority of the church, which would imply that, well, only through the agency of the Pope and so on, mm-hmm. and the whole hierarchy.
Luther was opposed to many things in the hierarchical church. He didn't believe that there were priests in the New Testament church, and the Catholic Church did. He didn't believe, in indulgences, which was one of the big things that set him off. He wasn't a believer in the seven sacraments being means of grace. He didn't believe that the Pope of Rome is over all the churches and so forth. These are some of the things that the Roman Catholics had held, and which he had held, because he was a Roman Catholic.
That's right. That's
He, when I say he was an Augustinian, I mean in his Catholic years, he was an Augustinian. He was an Augustinian Catholic monk. When he became a reformer, he was no longer part of the Augustinian order of monks, but nor a Roman Catholic. But he still had, of course, the influence from his youth.
Did he himself form the Lutherans, or did that come after, based on what he had taught?
I'm not sure what the Lutheran denomination would say for themselves about that. I'm sure they traced their movement back to Luther. And certainly when Luther survived the attempts of the Roman Catholic Church to kill him and, escaped into the castle of the King of Germany and published his works from there and distributed them before the Catholics could find him and kill him, as they were trying to do, I'm sure that Germany, who were influenced by Luther, and who tended to reject the Catholic Church because of Luther's writings,
right?
I'm sure they would have properly been called Lutheran. I think Germany probably would have been called Lutheran, though I don't know if that term was in use yet.
Well, did he live out his natural life?
He did, yeah. He died a natural death. He was one of the few people in those days who managed to do that, because there were people who taught a lot of the same things he did 100 years before Luther. John Huss, for example, and William Tyndale. Taught many of the same things that Luther did, and John Wycliffe. These men were before Luther, some of them by 100 or more years, and yet these men were persecuted. John Huss was burned at the stake by the Roman Catholics, and Tyndale was killed similarly by the Roman Catholics, and Wycliffe survived, the Roman Catholics sought to kill him, but he had too many powerful friends in England, and that's where he lived, and he really wasn't.
But I've always assumed that the Protestant message was that Jesus, God is there, available to all who would turn to him, and that it had completely refuted the Augustinian notion of predestination. So yesterday,
the Augustinian notion of predestination is actually called Reformed theology. It's basically that which was embodied in Calvin's writings and anticipated also in Luther's a generation earlier. Anyway, I've got my lines full now,
right,
Michael. I have to run.
Thank you. That was very, very educational. Thank you so much.
Okay. Appreciate your call.
Sure. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye now. Okay. Travis from Everett, Washington is next. Travis, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks.
Yeah, hey, I had a question about the different races of people, and it I've talked to a couple people about it. It's pretty mind-boggling when you think about only 8 in all, according to the Bible, was saved on Noah's Ark.
Yeah.
And for instance, if an African-American person who's black keeps sleeping with a black person, it'll continue to be a black person. If an Asian sleeps with an Asian, it'll continue to be Asian. So when did all the ethnics come in? Did all the different races come in? I hear the Tower of Babel, but all that happened on the Tower of Babel was the change of languages.
Yeah.
Had nothing about new races of people.
I agree. Well, let me try to address that. Many times the question arises, how could all the races have come from just 8 people? But when you think about it, all the races came from just 2 people, Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve are the parents of all living human beings, according to Scripture. The word Eve, in fact, was is from the Hebrew word Chava, living, and it says she was named that because she's the mother of all living. So every race of people, red and yellow, black and white, that are all precious in His sight, they're all from Adam and Eve. And then later, they're all also from Noah's family. But if it's impossible for all these races to come from a single family, then of course it's impossible for them all to come from Adam and Eve too. What we know these days, especially in modern times where we have more scientific knowledge, is that it's entirely possible for the gene pool of one couple to contain all the necessary genes and genetic information to produce all the present types of people that there are. Now, you're right. If two people who are white continue to only reproduce with each other and their offspring who are white only reproduce with other white people, then you're never going to see any other changes than white skin in that particular line. But here's what we have to realize, is that all of the genes for dark skin of all varieties of darkness, of all the traits of humanity, all those genes can be within the genetic pool of one couple, and obviously had to be if we all came from Adam and Eve. There are couples today, I don't know any of them, but I've read about them, who have sufficient genetic information between the father and mother that they can have as many as 9 different colors of children between them, because they themselves aren't just from a purely white or black line. In fact, they themselves, the parents, each have a black parent and a white parent. Now, therefore, you have in this couple, genetics for quite a variety of different skin colors and things like that. And that variety of genetics must have been in Adam and Eve also. We don't know what Adam and Eve looked like, but whatever they looked like, all the colors that they didn't possess were apparently recessively in their genes. And so I believe that they gave rise to them. Now, that still doesn't tell us where the races came from. That is to say, why they became races. Why is it that, the people who were indigenous to the African continent were black, people indigenous to the far northern European regions were white, and why the Asian, the people in Asia had the features that they have that set them apart distinguish them. In my understanding, and this is simply, we aren't told the answer, but here's a scenario that it's not hard for me to imagine, that if Adam's children and later Noah's children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren eventually were a very large variety of colors of skin, colors of hair, body shapes, body sizes, facial characteristics, and so forth. All these can come from a single family. You can find people today who have 4 children, and the children look very different from each other in, eye color and nose shape and size of the children and so forth. It's easy to imagine that one family, like Noah's family, could have had eventually, at least in their grandchildren and great-grandchildren, a wide variety of different-looking people. And some of the differences would be skin color and things like that, too. Now, if that is so, another thing that we know is that people often are attracted to persons who share their own characteristics more than they're attracted to people who don't.
Yeah.
Let's face it, a person who's, real heavy, often they're attracted to other people who are real heavy, maybe because they have similar lifestyles, and that's what makes them heavy or whatever. I don't know. But you'll often see that people are attracted to others who look a lot like them. And that doesn't mean it's universally so. Some white women are very much attracted to black men and vice versa and so forth. But in general, by the law of averages, people with whiter skin tend to find other people who are their same color. They tend to assume they're more like them, whether they are or not. And they tend to be attracted to them. And so with some exceptions, whiter people probably tended to pair up with whiter people, even if they were all one family, and darker people with darker people.
I think the thing with me is it's still hard to wrap my head around it, because, I know it doesn't say in the Bible, but then I almost think that he recreated some races after the flood. He might have created the black people. He might have created Asians and Arabs and people from India are a totally different race of themselves. Nobody looks like people from India. And
but everybody is really of the same race because they can all intermarry and have children. You see,
yeah, I understand that. I understand.
A dog can't do that with a cat. Yeah.
He might have created some races after the flood. I don't know. I just, it's hard to wrap your head around.
Right. I mean, obviously some people don't trust the record of Genesis, but if we do, Genesis chapter 10 tells us that from these three sons of Noah and their families, the entire earth was overspread with the peoples. And then it gives a list. Actually, chapter 10 of Genesis is called the Table of Nations. And it gives a list of those people who are descended from Shem, and those who are descended from Ham, and those who are descended from Japheth. And really, the only ethnic group that doesn't seem to be clearly defined for us there would be what we would call Asian people. That is, people who have distinctly what we'd call Asian characteristics. But that doesn't mean they didn't come from them. It does describe those who were, you know, Babylonians and Assyrians and people of the far north, and people of Africa are mentioned too. Ethiopians and Egyptians and Libyans are mentioned. And so we do read that the people of Africa and the people of North Europe and so forth, and of the Middle East, that they all came from Adam's sons. Now, I have no doubt that the people further east, you know, the Chinese and the Japanese and the Indian people and so forth, that they also were people who, a branch of the family that came off of one of the others that are mentioned. There's no specific mention of India or China in the Table of Nations, but there's no reason why the people of those regions couldn't have descended like the others did from Noah's family. We know that people who were the Native Americans and also, you know, the Aboriginal peoples of Australia, for example, they are believed to have traveled to the North American and South American continents and to Australia at some point, having been, you know, originating somewhere else first. Like the Native Americans are thought to have then come over from Asia, and the Aboriginals apparently from Africa, just judging by their characteristics. And so, you know, the point is that people of all parts of the world, the Bible claims, were descended from Noah and his sons. And as difficult as that might be for some people to assume to be true, I think we could either believe what God said about that or deny that God said anything and just, you know, doubt that the book of Genesis is authoritative at all. But if we take it as an authority, then it would suggest that all the people of the world came from Noah's family.
Right. Another question I had, Steve, is how did the animals get spread to the islands, like kangaroos and dingoes?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. My belief, my tentative belief, until something else is proven to be otherwise, is that after the flood, the bodies of land, which are now very, you know, spread out over the world, were not so far from each other. And some of the continents might have even been attached to each other. I don't know. But we do know there's been movement. Most, I think, geologists who acknowledge that there's movement of the continents would say it's taken billions of years, you know, for that movement to take place. But all they really have to go on, I think, is, you know, the present rate of movement. And suppose this continental drift was a fairly rapid process after the flood, and what we see, the speed that is happening now, is simply the slowing down, just because the energy that the earth generated to cause the drift may be dissipating and it may be going much slower. I'm not a scientist, obviously, and there are people who are scientifically trained and sophisticated listening to me right now who would not agree with anything I'm saying and would say, you know, boy, is he ever naive. Well, maybe I am, but I don't believe that science has disproved anything the Bible says. I do believe that some scientists have disagreed with what the Bible says. That's very obvious.
Well, I think there's a lot more to that too, Steve. Like I was telling you before, that they have now documented that Ron Wyatt found the Ark, Noah's Ark. The Turkish government went out there, dug around the boat,
He also found the Mountain of Moses in Jabal Lahz in Saudi Arabia. Everything was there, the split rock, the cave, the 12 pillars, the altar. It's all there. It's guarded with gates. There's a lot of archaeological evidence out there. And I think,
Ron Wyatt's findings are somewhat more controversial than some others. And a lot of people have questioned Ron Wyatt's, findings. But the point is there's a ton of archaeological evidence that supports Old Testament history to a very large degree. Yeah.
Sodom and Gomorrah, the Tower of Babel in modern-day Iraq. And even with the people who question Ron Wyatt, they can go right ahead and Brit. He was just an ordinary guy, barely had money to pay for a motel room. And I have no reason to question him because the guy is genuine. That's how I feel about it.
Yeah, well, he's deceased now, of course, and we can't really talk to him about it. I would say is that if Ron Wyatt's discoveries are legitimate, then he did discover some very remarkable confirmations of some of the stories in the Bible that had not previously been confirmed. But even if Ron Wyatt had never lived and never published, never discovered a thing, even if there was no Ron Wyatt or his discoveries, archaeology had already gone a huge distance toward confirming hundreds of things that the Bible said.
Yeah.
And
archaeology
has never disproven anything the Bible says. And again, it has confirmed what the Bible said, even details which skeptics had argued were not true in the Bible. The skeptics have had their mouths shut by the findings of archaeology more than once, many times.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I appreciate your call, Travis.
Okay, thanks. Have a good
God
day.
God bless you. Thanks for your call. All right, Terry from Las Vegas, Nevada, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you so much. The other night we had some door knockers come to our house and put forth their belief. They claim to be born-again Christians, but they claim that there are a male and female God, and which brought up obviously many responses. But they quickly went to scriptures in the Bible to justify their remarks, and which I quickly replied to where it says, "I am God. I am the only God. There are no others."
Yeah.
And he said, "Well, the Hebrew word for God in that form is a plural God." And I said, "Well, I don't know. I'm not authoritative on that. So I'll have to have time to look that up." And then he quickly went to Genesis and said that God created man in his image, male and female. And I said, "Well, I always thought that God created man in his image." But when I went back to Genesis in 26 and 27, I see that it repeats itself twice, where he says, "Let us make man in our image." And then in 27, he says, God created man in his own image, in the image of God. He created him male and female. So I see where it leaves room for him to say something like that, but I don't know if my chronological way of thinking is wrong, but I don't see the...
Well, let me ask you this. Were these people associated with any particular group or organization?
No, he just said we're born-again Christians and we're out to teach the truth about the Bible that most people overlook.
Now, why would they think that this is a truth they need to teach when neither Jesus nor the apostles taught it?
Well, I couldn't come up with every answer to
they're totally wrong. I believe they're totally wrong, though they do have an argument that God said, "Let us make man in our image," and Christians have always had to make some kind of effort to explain the use of the plural there. God did make man in his own image, mankind, male and female, he created them. This has led many people to believe that God has, features of man and woman, and that mankind, the male and female, as a couple, together, combined, they have features of the divine image. That doesn't mean there's two gods. But there are these passages, the word Elohim, which is the word God in many places in the Old Testament, can be taken as a plural, but in many cases it cannot be taken as a plural, judging from the grammar of the sentence. Sometimes Elohim can mean gods, or sometimes it cannot mean gods. It has to be translated God, depending on the verb tenses. So, you know, they have a little bit of a scrap of evidence, you know, for what they want to say. But all of those evidences are capable of being interpreted in a less radical way. Now, in other words, I believe they have no evidence from the things they mentioned to suggest there are two gods, a male and a female. But let's just suggest for a moment that the verses they used could maybe even allow that possibility. I don't think they can. I think there's much better ways to explain those verses. But let's say that that's even one of the possibilities on the table, given the evidence they use. Let's say there's a possibility there's a triune God, such as Christianity has always taught. Or let's say the words could also be used to suggest there's a male and a female God, a God and a goddess. Well, which did Jesus teach? You know, he didn't, you know, we have his teachings in Greek. We don't have the word Elohim in the teaching of Jesus. And therefore, we don't have that ambiguity. How many gods did Jesus say there are? How many gods did Paul say there are? Who did Jesus say we're supposed to be worshiping? If there is a male God and a female God, is there some reason why Jesus kept that to be a secret? Why would he keep it a secret? Why would he never mention it? And let me just say this. If there is a female God, which I will affirm there is not, but if there is, and Jesus was simply keeping it a secret, then it must be a secret worth keeping. And it's not something we would ever have to know about. I mean, if we died and went to heaven and found that God had a consort, a female God, well, then that's when we would find it out. But I have no doubt that the Bible denies this. But the point is, anyone who says, we're going around trying to teach people the true Christianity. Well, the true Christianity is what Jesus taught, isn't it? It's not what you read into ambiguous Hebrew words in the Old Testament. That's not what true Christianity is based on. True Christianity is based on the teaching of Jesus and the apostles. So if they want to teach some esoteric doctrine that involves gods and goddesses, well, anyone's free to teach whatever they want to, but no one should suggest that that's true Christianity, since true Christianity would have to agree with what Jesus and the apostles said, and he certainly didn't leave any room for that possibility.
Right, right. Well, that, like I say, when I threw the verse of I am God and I am a jealous God and there are no others, then that's when he came back and said, Elohim, that's plural, meaning gods, inferring that, you know, God and goddess. And so,
well, here's one of those places. Here's one of those places that says that. Okay, in Isaiah 43, verse 10 and 11, is one of the many places where God says there's no other one but Himself. But He says, at the end of Isaiah 43:10, before me there was no God formed, nor shall there be after me. Now, God there is either El or Elohim. I don't know at this point because I'm not looking at the Hebrew. But the very next verse says, I am Yahweh. And beside me, there is no Savior. Now, Yahweh is not a plural word. Yahweh is the name of the God who revealed himself to Moses in the burning bush. And if you look over at chapter 44 of Isaiah, verse 8, it says, you are my witnesses. Is there a God besides me? Indeed, I know no other rock. I know not one. I don't know one. God doesn't know of any God besides himself. And who's speaking? Yahweh is speaking. If he had a female goddess with him, then that would be some other one than him. Now, if someone says, but you know, you could suggest that he's saying there's no other male gods, but there's a female God. Well, you could say anything you want to, but back it up. You know, there's no way to back it up. We could say there's a six-headed God out there. Except why would we say it? There's really nothing in the Bible to say it, so why would you say it? There's nothing in the Bible that says there's a female God out there, so why would they say it? And so to me, these people are just, you know, I meet people like this. When you've been around as much as I have, you meet all kinds of strange people who think they see something that no one else has ever seen. And, you know, they want to back it up, but they don't have any scripture to back it up. They think that this word or this grammatical thing or this this verse here might allow their theory to maybe be true, But in every case, what they've done is they've come up with something that no one else has thought of before, and they try to think of some verses that can shoehorn into their viewpoint. Right. They don't get their viewpoint from exegeting the scripture. They get a hunch somewhere, and then they try their hunch on several different passages, most of which could not really support it. But if they find one or two that seem like they could, then they're all over it.
Well, it led me to a curious question, okay? Other than all of that, it led me to a curious question of the chronological order, because when you read in Genesis 1:26, it said, let him make man in our image. Okay, mm-hmm. I'm good with that. I believe in that our is the Trinity. And then in 27, it says created man and female in his image. Okay, that's mm-hmm. the next verse. And then it goes on in chapter 2 to say Eve was created from man. So I don't know if my chronological order, if I'm out of order, or was female created before Eve, or am I just not?
No. The events of chapter 2 of Genesis, chapter 2, verse 4 through the rest of the chapter, those don't happen chronologically after chapter 1. Chapter 1 gives the whole week of creation, 6 days of creation. The final act of creation on the sixth day is the creation of man and woman, okay? And then chapter 4 begins by talking about how God rested on the seventh day, and then that ends that particular narrative. Then in chapter 2 and verse 4, it gives an entirely different look at the creation of man and woman, a different look at the same subject. Okay. It's not saying, now these things happened after those things. You can tell that it's not, because in chapter 2, verse 4, it talks about a time before there were men, before there were people on the earth, and before it rained and a mist went up to water the ground. This is a situation that prevailed before the sixth day of Genesis 1. So we're clearly going back chronologically to look at an earlier period that's been passed over lightly in the first account. And this is like a sidebar in a magazine article. I don't know if anyone reads magazines anymore. They all get their stuff online. But there used to be things called magazines with stories in them. And, and you know, occasionally there'd be what they called a sidebar. It looks like you hung up on me, but that was probably an accident. Anyway, I can still talk to you, Terry. A sidebar is, you know, a box that has additional information about something that's passed over lightly in the main story. And that's what I believe chapter 2 of Genesis is. It's like a sidebar on the creation of man and woman. We're told very briefly on the sixth day in Genesis 1:27 that God made man and woman. In chapter 2, we say, let's take a little closer look at that. He made man first, and then he made woman from the man. He slows the story down in order to give more detail about its most important feature. Anyway, I don't know of any Bible scholar that believes that Genesis 2 is describing events that happened chronologically later than Genesis 1, but it's pretty much standard explanation that chapter 2 is looking at the same material, giving more detail on an important point. Well, the music's playing, and that means I've got to watch the clock because they're going to be cutting me off here in about 60 seconds. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. If you're not familiar with this program, get familiar with us. What's wrong with you? You should be listening all the time. We're on every day, Monday through Friday at the same time. If you're available, we'd love to have you listening and calling with your questions. We've been doing this for like 17 years or more, every weekday. And we'll continue doing so as long as we can pay for the time on the radio. And that's how we're on the air. We buy time on radio stations. We are listener-supported, and therefore we depend on listener support to pay those bills. If you'd like to help us stay on the air on the station you're listening to, you could write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can just go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, where there's a lot of free things, but also the opportunity to donate at thenarrowpath.com. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless you. Thank you.